From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Cadet. You're listening to Idaho Matters. As Halloween gets closer, more and more people are sitting down to rewatch their favorite horror classics, whether it's Michael Myers on the hunt for Laurie Strode or a bunch of high schoolers trying to evade Ghostface. Stories of mystery and murder are always popular around this time of year, especially true stories, which Idaho has plenty of. Whitney Rivera and Camden Shacker explore Idaho crimes and murders in their podcast, Ghosts and Garnets, and they're joining us today to share some of the Gem State's horror stories. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, we're so excited to be back.
Well, we are so excited to have you guys on. Hey, and a quick note to our listeners, there will be graphic descriptions throughout this segment, and we will be talking about accusations of rape. So just be aware that we will be discussing some sensitive topics for the next little while. All right. So today, we're going to begin at one of Idaho's historic and well-known sites. And I mean, I think we could even say probably most haunted sites. That's the Old Pen in Boise, with Ronald Lee. Is it Masick?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Masick. Okay. So he is the only prisoner that's still serving time, and he served time at both the Old Pen off of Warm Springs while it was still open, and he is 75 years old. So can we just start with how you kind of even found out about this individual?
Well, I'm obsessed with the Old Pen, and it's my favorite place. Cam and I went there when we were in grade school for a field trip. And I just was fascinated since I was a little kid about it. So every few months, I like to cover something that has some kind of connection to the pen, just so I have the excuse to go to the archives and dig through things. And so when I came across, I thought, well, let's cover one of the riots. And I came across this case because it was directly related to the riot. And we went from there.
Okay, so let's go back then to the 1971 riot, which was called the Blood Riot.
Yes.
So let's listen to this clip from your podcast, Ghosts and Garnets.
21-year-old Ronald Masick entered the Old Pen in 1969 after being convicted of robbing a bar in Kellogg, Idaho. The pen had been operational for around 99 years at this point, and it was not what you'd call human-friendly accommodations. Conditions were awful, and escapes became so common, residents that lived in the neighborhood that had sort of grown around the Idaho Pen, the Warm Springs Avenue neighbors, they had taken to erecting prisoner crossing signs because escapes happened so often. Beyond its claustrophobic quarters, and these are old buildings, they're made of sandstone. It is freezing in the winter. It is scorching in the summer. It is miserable. But beyond that, there is no ventilation, tiny solitary confinement cells known as Siberia. And the penitentiary also did not segregate the most dangerous prisoners from the general population. Everyone was just sort of thrown together. And up until the mid-19-teens, like 1915, I can't remember the exact time, women prisoners were just thrown in with the men, which did not end well, if you can imagine. No. So meanwhile, guards that were manning the catwalks and the poorly situated towers atop the sandstone exterior walls received almost no training. One guard later commenting, quote, "It was literally, here's your uniform and a gun. Go out and guard."
Okay, so let's start in the summer of 1971, because things got even worse than what you just described right there. Because yes, one of the dorms was shut down. And this is called the Honors Dorm. Oh, okay.
Yes.
So tell us.
Like an oxymoron.
It's such an oxymoron. Okay. So tell us what happened. Why was the dorm shut down, the Honors Dorm?
It was shut down originally in July of that year. Officials found a tunnel, an escape tunnel, leading from the Honors Dorm, which was Five House, to the exterior wall, and it ended around 4 feet from the exterior wall when they caught it. And for some reason, they didn't think this was a very big deal, and they didn't make any changes. And then 3 weeks later, they found another escape tunnel underneath the honors dorm. And at that point, that's when they finally shut Five House down.
Okay. So when they did that, then they just moved everybody to another house, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yes. There were only two buildings that prisoners were operational. They were the only two buildings left that were operational once they shut down Five House. So they had other buildings with cells, but they had already closed them down because they were either, you know, condemned or they didn't have the money to run them. Right. So yes, the massive overcrowding on top of everything else.
Well, and folks have to understand, I mean, if you've not been to the old Idaho Pen, I mean, first off, I mean, this was what it had been running for almost 100 years. I mean, there, as you said, there hadn't been a lot of updating to these buildings, yet it was still the state penitentiary. So let's go to now, what, August of 71? It's summertime. It's hot in the Treasure Valley in August. And all of a sudden, the prisoners start rioting. But how did that happen?
So I think there had been a buildup, and the addition of all of these extra men in these cells didn't help matters. But this inmate, Ronald Lee Masick, had some kind of breakdown, and he ended up stabbing another inmate. And this led to a full-blown riot that lasted almost 4 hours.
Wow. Okay. I want to listen to the description of what happened during the riot, because you have a great description of it in the podcast. So let's listen back to this.
During this 3-hour shit show, the social services building and bakery was set on fire, and inmates destroyed the multi-purpose building. Inmates helped themselves to drugs from the hospital's hot box, and a prisoner who worked in the infirmary was stabbed trying to stop them from stealing the meds. Reporters from the Idaho Statesman stood on the wall talking to prisoners while they grilled steaks on the lawn in front of the dining hall. The Idaho State Police were called in, and eventually Warden Raymond May walked unarmed into the compound to negotiate with the inmate council.
I mean, in the middle of them barbecuing. And not to make light of it. So the warden enters the old pen to negotiate. He's unarmed. The prisoners had 6 complaints that they wanted addressed before they would agree that they'd end the riot. Let's hear a couple of these from what you guys described.
3, water system infested by rats. Sick. 4, food unsanitary. 5, visitors. They could only have visitors once every 2 weeks. 6, amnesty for rioters with the exception of those who set fires and stab people. The negotiation was successful, and the riot was over.
And when it says water system infested by rats, they had this big water tank up on a hill. It had not been cleaned out for as long as Warden May had been there, which was years. And about a week before the riot, it finally was cleaned out for the very first time. And it was cleaned out by one of the prisoners, who found dead rats and mice inside the water tank and in the pipes leading to the prison, and said that there were, quote, too many parts to be from just one.
That's disgusting. And I am telling you, nothing makes me more cranky than being hot and sweaty.
Yes.
Not being able to clean myself.
Yes. And then you have to put dirty clothes back on.
And not to have some cold water.
Yeah.
They're such minimal basic things, you know?
Well, and they also were complaining. The reason that they were saying that the food was unsanitary was because apparently the guys they had working in the kitchen were like guys that were known to have syphilis.
Oh my God. It's like, if this is not a deterrent to committing crime, I do not know what is, people.
Yeah. And the fact that the warden was like, valid, valid, valid. Like, he didn't know all of this was happening prior to the riot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so basically they'd been drinking rat water for years.
Yes.
I mean, I know it's prison, but come on.
I think the least amount that I would do would be stabbing someone and cooking a steak. That would probably be the very least.
Come on. Okay. So this actually works and the riot ends. However, a few days after the riot ends, there's another inmate, William Henry Butler, and his body is found in a rolled up gym mat. And this leads back once again to Masick. So let's listen to that.
Now, there are two different accounts of what happened to Bill Butler on August 11th, 1971. So we're going to tell you Masick's account of what happened, and then we're going to tell you what authorities think really happened. So according to Masick and a couple of other inmates, Butler was the worst kind of predator. They said both prior to and during the riot, Bill Butler preyed upon numerous other prisoners, brutally raping multiple men, using the shower area by the boxing arena in the gym for his assaults. Masick said that during the riot, he went with Bill Butler to the gymnasium boxing ring area. And he said he was going to get into it with him about the fact that Butler had raped a friend of his. That's why he said he brought Butler down there. When they walked in, several other inmates, including a man named Danny Powers and a guy named William Burt, were there drinking homemade wine. And Masick said they were wasted. And he said, Butler said something that f***ed the guys off. The other guys jumped Butler, and that Burt hit Butler in the head with a 10-pound weight. He then said Powers shanked Butler multiple times and that the motive was to punish Butler for raping their friends. That's what Masick said happened. Now, what officials believe happened was that Butler was the focus of a coordinated attack based on the fact that he had not participated in the riots. According to William Burt, fellow inmates had bet him that he couldn't take Butler down in one blow with a barbell. And he was like, I'll take that bet. And Masick lured Butler to the area so that Burt could hit him in the back of the head with a 10-pound barbell so he could win this bet. Burt said he had no idea that Powers and Masick had planned on murdering Butler when he got down there. And then at that point, either Masick or Powers stabbed Butler 6 times in the chest and twice in the throat. And Burt took a polygraph and said that he thought that Masick had killed Butler because he snitched on him about stabbing Rice earlier in the day, which started the riot.
So what happened from there?
Oh, gosh. So from there, they didn't look for him for a couple of days. And yeah. I think I found that fascinating that they just thought, well, not so much a big deal that this guy is missing. It took them 4 days and they weren't looking for him. Guards just stumbled across his body rolled up in a gym mat.
That's crazy.
Then they realized that he had been murdered 4 days prior.
Okay. So Masick was convicted for the crime, but my understanding is there was another inmate who actually confessed to Butler's murder. Is that accurate?
Yes. Danny Powers confessed almost immediately after the crime, and Masick was not aware of this confession until, the mid-1980s.
Okay. And so Masick has appealed this conviction several times, but
yes,
as we said in the beginning of this conversation, he's still in, he's in the, I guess we can call it the new pen.
Yeah. Yes.
And
he's been there forever.
Yeah. It seems like forever. So This is really what this whole riot basically is what shut down the old pen. Can you guys talk a little bit about that? I mean, and I think part of it was, is that it just, they couldn't rebuild it.
Yes, I think so. They started construction on the new pen 11 years before this riot started.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yep. And so they had been planning on moving it for a while, but it still wasn't finished. They actually didn't end up moving everyone until 1973 after another riot. So it took another riot before they finally got.
So this one wasn't bad enough.
Right.
Yes. This one wasn't bad enough.
They needed another one. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. All right. I want to switch gears for a second because you guys have your first live event coming up this weekend. And as part of that, you're going to be taking a look at another case that took place at the Old Pen. So can you tell us, give us a little bit of what you might be talking about this weekend?
So we are going to be talking about an inmate in the 1930s named Douglas Van Vlack, who was convicted of murdering his ex-wife and two police officers in Idaho.
And is he one of the prisoners who is purported to still haunt the Old Pen?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So he is. And I actually was reading something the other day. This woman who claims she's a psychic was touring the Old Pen and said to her guide that Van Vlack was standing on top of one of the cell houses spitting at her during their visit. I know.
Ew. So this is the perfect story to revisit ahead of Halloween for your life.
Yes.
Event.
Yes.
We're going to turn now from the Idaho Pen to the Meridian suburbs, where a love affair went terribly wrong. I mean, this changed two families forever. The saying goes, nothing good ever happens after dark, even in a place as inconspicuous as a Walgreens parking lot, which is where Robert Hall finds his wife, Candy, with her boss, Emmett Corrigan, one fateful night.
You see Emmett's truck come into the parking lot, and he's like barreling through the parking lot. He's speeding through the parking lot way too fast. He parks his truck, and both men get out of their trucks, and they start arguing with each other. And Candy gets out of the truck, and she's standing next to Rob. And Rob's like, to Emmett, he says, "What are you doing with my wife at 10 o'clock at night?" And Emmett starts saying things like, "Candy doesn't want to be with you anymore. You don't make any money. I make more money in a week than you do in a year." Horrible shit. All he was trying to do was make Rob feel like trash. He's like, "Candy, how much money did we make last week? $37,000. That's how much we make together, Rob. And you can't even make that in a year? Gross, sir." And Rob's like, "Dude, what are you doing? You have a wife at home who just had a baby. You have five kids. What about your kids?" And Emmett, he had been leaning against his truck. And when Rob brings up his kids, he pushes off the truck and he walks over to Rob, shoves him. Candy says at this point, she gets in the middle of them and says, "That's enough. Emmett, get in your truck. Rob, let's go." And she says she turned around to start walking to her car, but a car is driving through the parking lot. So she has to stop. And she says when she stops, she hears what she described as multiple pops. She said, "I didn't know what the sound was." And in her peripheral vision, she sees Rob and he's covered in blood. And then Rob falls to the ground and she turns around and both men are on the ground covered in blood. Candy calls 911 and you can hear her on the phone. She's hysterical. She's screaming and she keeps saying, "Oh my God, Robert, Robert, Robert," and then just screaming over and over again.
So I feel like if you haven't heard about this story, you just haven't lived in Idaho long enough because this has made, I mean, not just national headlines. I mean, I think there have been datelines. There's been so much coverage of this story. Right. So if for perchance you have been living under a rock, tell us how all three of them ended up in that parking lot that night. And this was what, like March of 2011, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there had been an affair going on for months. At this point, Rob was suspicious of Candy and Emmett. Candy had been lying about the affair, but earlier that evening had told Rob she was having an affair, but it was not with Emmett, which was a lie. Then she went to pick up a prescription. Emmett texted her. They ended up meeting up. And then one of Candy and Rob's daughters saw her car in the Walgreens parking lot and tried to call her. She didn't pick up. And so She called her dad and said, why is mom's car in the Walgreens parking lot? At this point, Rob knows something is going on, so he drives to the Walgreens parking lot. And all of this is caught on security camera footage.
Yeah, it's caught on footage, on security footage, just like you said. But the story of what ultimately happened in that parking lot changes several times. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Candy has a lot of stories to tell. And we've never really gotten a straight answer. Unfortunately, the only witnesses are Candy and Rob. And they both have changed their stories multiple times. So initially, the story was that Rob didn't remember anything. That was his recollection, was that he didn't remember anything, that he had a concussion, and that he didn't know what had happened. Candy said that Emmett had instigated the whole thing and that she had never seen the shooting. She had just heard the pops. Then Rob's story changes and he says he does remember that Emmett pulled his sweatshirt over his head, knocking him to the ground, where he dropped the gun. And he said Emmett picked the gun up. And the last thing he remembers is Emmett pointing the gun at him. So he's now claiming that Emmett initially shot at him and he wrestled the gun away and ended up shooting Emmett in return, which is not what the evidence suggests happened. Candy multiple times refuses to admit that she is having an affair with her boss. And it comes out that she, over the past few months, has told everyone in her office, including her boss, who she was having an affair with, that Rob was physically abusing her. So she had Emmett, who was on steroids, all kinds of worked up, thinking that this man was abusing her, which was not true.
I mean, there are so many twists and turns to this. And, you know, when I first started listening to this episode, one of the first things one of you said was, look, no one deserves to die in this manner. No one deserves to be murdered. And that's 100% true. But when you dig into this story, and it's one of these things where you're like, these were just poor choices over and over and over again, really by Emmett and Candy. And then, you know, Rob gets in the midst of this, and two families are literally imploded. And yet Rob is arrested. I mean, that's what the evidence shows, is that he shot and killed Emmett. He went to trial. What happened at that point?
At that point, it's one of those court moments where you look at the defense attorney and you think, what in the hell were you thinking, sir? They put Candy on the stand as a defense witness, and she spent several days clearly committing perjury, so much so that the judge said when the jury left the courtroom that he had never seen a witness lie so much on the stand. Thoroughly discredited is what he said, which was just judge speak for liar, liar, pants on fire.
Pants on fire.
Yeah.
So yes, Rob ultimately ended up going to prison, correct?
Yes. Yes. He's still in prison.
Okay. Was Candy ever convicted of anything? I just don't remember, because there are so many layers to this case.
So Candy was convicted of something, but she was not convicted of anything having to do with this case. She was arrested several months after Emmett's murder for embezzling $30,000 from her former employer, the person that she worked for before Emmett. And she ended up being convicted of that, was sentenced to 14 years in prison, but got on a writer program because she had no criminal history, and only ended up spending about 6 months in a baby criminal halfway house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have to say, if you have not heard this story, go and listen to this Ghosts and Garnets episode, because your mind will be blown, seriously. Before I let the two of you go, let's talk a little bit about your upcoming live show. I mean, you are literally going to be doing your show live. When and where is this happening?
So this will be happening on Saturday. Our show is at 1:30 at the Idaho Botanical Gardens for their Ghouls Day Out event. We will be there from 10 to 3 selling merchandise and just enjoying all of the festivities.
And then you'll do a live. Then you'll do a live show during that time.
Yes, our live show will be at 1:30 and there are 50 seats available. So get there early if you want to listen to us. And I hope that we show up, man.
You will. You will be great. What is it? So how long has the podcast been going on now?
We just celebrated our 1 year last week.
Wow. Okay. What has it been like this last year?
Wild, wild times. I can't believe, I don't think either of us can believe how well it has done. It's brought us closer, which has been maybe the best part, to work with your best friend every day and talk smack about naughty people, which is all culminated in this live event, you know, for our 1 year anniversary, basically. And so it's been a wild ride.
Well, congratulations to the two of you. Yeah. I mean, seriously, huge congrats. I mean, that's a lot of work to put in and 1 year in and then it doing so well and it's entertaining. And I just appreciate the two of you taking time out of your busy schedules to chat with us.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me, and I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on the Black experience. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get podcasts.